Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me.
I hope many aspects of your life are progressing.
My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 3 years of law enforcement analysis experience, all of which with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. She's currently a criminal intelligence analyst supervisor. She also is a victim advocate and has a master's in intelligence and crime analysis from St. Joseph's University. She is currently the president and one of the founders of the Mid-Atlantic Regional Association of Crime Analysts, also known as MRACA. Please welcome Akiko McLean. Akiko, how are we doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
I am doing very well. We have to explain that introduction a little bit for our listeners.
Yes, my pig squeal. Yes, I am just obsessed with your podcast and an avid listener and have been for a really long time. So I wanted to do that intro because I want to be famous like you, Jason, one day.
Oh, man, now you're making me blush. No, we met last year at the IACA conference in Chicago, and You had let me know that you put, I hope many aspects of your life are progressing, in your signature of your emails.
I do use it in emails when I know that the person does not listen to your podcast. So they know that I'm not copying. I will use it occasionally as my niceness, my buffer to, you know, get everyone to work with me and help me out.
Yeah. Well, it is flattering. I do appreciate you copying me, but I do take it as a compliment.
That's good.
All right. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
So I went to school for criminal justice at Temple University here in Philadelphia, and I graduated and I was like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And in my undergrad, it wasn't really shown that this was a whole field that you could go into. So I was like, do I do something in the social services field, or do I go become a police officer, or do I go become a lawyer? And so my first job out of college was as a victim advocate at a nonprofit in West Philadelphia. And so I did that for a couple years. Then I think I took that position, came over to the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office doing the same thing. And then I was like, I think I am very tired from working with victims, and it gets exhausting and it's sad and it's heavy, right? So I was like, maybe I need to go back to school and figure out, you know, what else I can do. So went back, got my master's at St. Joe's, and they at the time had a specific track for intelligence analysis. And I did that all during COVID. Conveniently, one good thing that came from COVID was I got my master's degree while also still working as a victim advocate, and then came out and got this job at the DA's office as they were starting up a unit.
Very good. So let's talk a little bit about the work that you did with as a victim advocate. Was it specific types of cases or victims that you were dealing with?
Yeah. So when I did it at the nonprofit in Philadelphia, we have a bunch of regional nonprofits that are dispersed throughout the city. And so mine in West Philly, we dealt with all of the victims in West Philadelphia. So we were working with like co-victims of homicide. We were working with those who were maybe just like hit in a hit and run. We were working with people who had their homes burglarized, or literally anything that came through and was on the police reports. We would send out mail to them. We would give them a call. We would meet them in court. We would help them with any sort of victim compensation and reimbursement that we could. My agency also had a counseling service that we provided free to victims of crime. So we were able to give that out and refer people to that, children as well. So it was great. It helped me learn a lot. And then I think that helped me get all my connections with those at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office and helped me kind of like learn how the court process worked, how the police process worked, all from like an outside perspective, not being a lawyer or a police officer.
Yeah. So what is the viewpoint of the victims? At least I'll keep it to the ones that you dealt with. I mean, in terms of what are they looking for? What were some issues from an outsider point of view that wasn't a victim advocate wouldn't necessarily think of?
Yeah. It is interesting to see some of the same victims come back just because, you know, there is that idea that if you have been victimized, you are more likely to be re-victimized. And so I would see some people come back through the system again, and I'd be like, oh, hi, yep, I'm still here. And what happened now? I'm so sorry about all that and whatever. So that was interesting to see people repeat through the system. But otherwise, it was great to be able to work with them in the community, because they really appreciated us, my agency and each of the other agencies, like being where they are. So they could just come, it's in their neighborhood. We help them, we'll like help them organize their receipts or whatever they needed. If they needed funeral expenses covered, we were helping them and explaining it step by step. We could like drive out to their home and like pick up forms for them if they needed, or if they needed like medical bills covered or reimbursed, we were there. And I think no one knew. If you're a first time victim, like you don't know all those resources are out there. So it was great to be able to show people that. And then I still take that with me now. And I'm trying to make sure anyone I know who gets victimized knows that all these resources are out there. And even still, as a crime analyst, if there's a case and one of the attorneys that I'm working with needs assistance, then I'm happy to call them and like refer out or explain the process. So it was great. I loved it. Miss it sometimes.
You started out with the nonprofit, which is Anti-Violent Partnership, and then yes. You went to work for the district attorney's office, same title. So what was the difference between those two?
Yeah, it was interesting, actually. The difference is, at least here, so the nonprofit ones, they're out there in the communities, and they're helping like with the reimbursement. They're going to court with you at the preliminary hearing level, more so. And then the victim advocates that are in the district attorney's office, like they were providing the same information, but since they're in the district attorney's office, which is like right in the center of our city, they were not so much easily accessible unless you were right in that central location. So with the DA's office, you were doing lots of phone calls and like just coordinating, making sure people are coming, doing like intermediary work between the attorneys and the victims, just again, making sure they had everything that they needed. If they needed any questions clarified, whether or not they were coming to court, like if we knew in advance that the case wasn't going to go, we would just let them know that like, hey, don't worry about it. Don't come down today. We'll touch base with you and whatnot. And then the victim advocates at the DA's office definitely intervened and helped more in the trial process. And they were there for like the long run in the second half of all of everything that went on. There's a difference, but some similarities, but it was interesting and it was great to do both.
All right. So absent of them not being victims in the first place, in terms of this whole process of what, from your vantage point, is there something that you wish you could improve with the whole process?
Yeah, I think the dealing with the different people for the victims would sometimes be a lot, because you would recount, especially if the incident was like really traumatic, you would recount this story over and over and over. You would call the police when it happened. You would tell them what happened. You would tell the responding officers when it happened, what happened. And then you would talk to the victim advocates from the nonprofits when they reached out, or you saw them at court at the preliminary hearing, and you would explain what happened and what you needed and how you needed help and how they could support. And then you had to go up on the stand and you would do the same thing. And then if it goes to trial, you know, most don't, but if it does go to trial and doesn't plead out, then you would again tell the story again and or explain it to the victim coordinator with the district attorney's office. So I feel like that could be just as bad as the crime, like recounting it over and over and over. And you have to keep going through it, keep going through the details. For some things, obviously, it's not so impactful. But for others, that would be exhausting. And I felt bad. I wish that there was some sort of continuity or something that could be done there.
All right. You started with the master's degree before taking the analyst position at the DA's office, correct?
Yes. Yep.
So you decided to get a master's, wanting to improve, looking at the landscape. What in particular drove you towards the intelligence and crime analyst study? Because to this point, there's nothing really on your radar about analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was two things, maybe. One, in my undergrad, I took a class, our research and analysis methods or whatever. The first time, did terrible. I had to withdraw from it. Second time I took it, I had like a 103 in the class and I really, really loved it. Love that. And I also love the statistics class that was required. So with those like in the back of my mind, I was like, maybe I can do something with that, you know? And then with the victim services, like it's so much social work and it's so much like documentation. And I was like, well, maybe I would enjoy more like, you know, sitting at a computer, like documenting, looking at it, analyzing what's going on, tracking the numbers and stuff like that. So that really pushed me into the master's program. And then took, well, let me see. I think I had taken like a civil service exam for a analyst job with the Philadelphia Police Department. And I was like in the hiring process for that. Still at the DA's office, still working as a crime analyst. Had either just finished or was finishing up the master's program. I think that was like December. And then one day I got a call from a random attorney in my office who was like, did you apply to this job with the police? And I was like, who are you? And yes, I did. But how do you know? I was like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. But actually it was because he knew some people at the police department and they were like, this woman works at your office and we're about to, you know, maybe try to bring her over here if you wanted to keep her, as we know you are trying to start an intel unit at the district attorney's office. So ended up, I just started talking to him and I ended up staying. And then we, along with a couple others, kind of brought this unit to life over the past couple of years in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office.
Yeah. Back to the research methods class. Did you have the same professor?
No, different professors.
Yeah.
And that actually helps. It really helped. It was like a game changer. So I tell everyone that too, that I like any younger kids that I am like talking with, my younger brother, I'm like, if it's not the class for you, and it could be the teacher or it could just be there's too much going on, definitely don't be afraid to withdraw or drop the class. Because when I took the second time around after one of the exams, the teacher took me out of the room and I was like, oh my God, I've been cheating and I didn't even know I was cheating. And I thought I did something wrong again. And he was like, well, can you tell me, can you explain why you're doing so well in this and like your test grades are so high compared to everyone else? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know, because I thought I was about to get in trouble. But it's really different teachers. Like they show it to you and explain it differently. And that made all the difference.
Yeah. I know as a teacher, I get frustrated because there's sometimes there's just some students I can tell aren't picking up what I'm putting down.
Right.
And sometimes it's been in a group setting. So I can call in another instructor to do different perspective. And to me, I said the exact same thing, but they got it when the second person said it.
You just got to say it like 10 more times.
Yeah. That it gets frustrating. But I do understand that sometimes it clicks just right with different people. And it's just the way it is. People learn and whatnot. So,
yeah, I don't know what it was, but thank goodness I retook it.
Yeah. Now, it is interesting, too, that you got the call from the district attorney, because that I found it a little bit odd when I was at a police department or an agency and I was shopping around for a different job. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't necessarily let them know that that's what I was doing. Right. Until I had to. Right. I think in the private sector, no one bats an eye if you want to go do something else. But I don't know if you felt it. I know I felt it in the government sector, and maybe it's even with police departments in particular. There does seem to be this extra layer of loyalty that mm-hmm. is expected. And so I always felt it a little bit weird to, as I was shopping around or looking for other jobs, to kind of keep it on the download that that's what I was doing. But I don't know if you felt the same way or not.
Yeah. And also actually the position I had taken a civil service test for like probably like a year ago. So basically I had forgotten about it anyways. Mm-hmm. And then when they like had started their interview process, I guess they had reached out to the attorney that they knew. And it's also even more shocking because we are district attorneys in our police office. We sometimes have some animosity, you know, we try. And we've mm-hmm. definitely made great progress, but sometimes we don't get along. So the fact that they were even like willing to just help out the mm-hmm. DA's office as we were trying to start up this unit, like that's great. Really appreciate it. And I feel very grateful for the opportunity I got to stay, because I have loved like getting to build out the unit. So very grateful that all of that somehow worked out.
And I do want to get to building the unit in a second, but I do want to finish up the master's degree. So it was a 1-year program, right? And
I smushed it into like a year and a half. It was because of COVID, it got booted to all being online. It was not supposed to be like that, but and I did it in like 4 semesters.
I see.
I took summer classes. Yeah.
Okay. So on this show, we we do talk from time to time about whether a master's degree is necessary to do the analyst work. And some people ask me, do you think I should go get a master's degree? So I just wanted to pick your brain on that a little bit. Do you, in looking back, do you think are you glad you got the master's? Do you think it really helped you in terms of your current position? Would you recommend it to other folks?
I would recommend. I felt like just because my undergrad was just criminal justice, just general, this like helps really zero in on particular things and kind of gain all those specialized skills. Whereas in my undergrad, it wasn't so much like that. And I do feel like more and more jobs are putting that in their requirements, even though I don't feel like it is necessarily better than experience. Like I feel like experience could be equivalent or is equivalent oftentimes, but funny, we actually used the IACA textbook in that time. And so I still have that book and I'll refer back all the time whenever I need something. So that like it did introduce me to also the IACA and then all those resources too. So I think if anything, like even just networking and meeting people, because I met colleagues that I work with. I met people at the district attorney's office while I was like there getting my master's. There were a bunch of police officers in there getting their master's degree as well. And then I worked with a professor on a research project. So I have a research paper coming out that will be published sometime eventually. Who knows when?
And what's it on?
It's on interrogation techniques and human intelligence and like what works and the different kinds of people you will come across when interviewing individuals.
All right. So how did you get wrapped up in that?
I decided that one of my last like little classes was going to be like one of the independent research studies. Mm-hmm. And I had a professor I really liked, and he does lots of work on interrogation techniques and tactics and best practices. And he was very helpful all throughout my time there at St. Joe's. And then we worked on that. But now, yeah, that's been like 2 years ago. And I think it's on its way to get published now. It's in review.
So what is your, I guess, what's your angle with the interrogation technique? Is there a certain one or a combination, or what's your message?
I think you do need a combo for sure. And it definitely needs to veer more towards the kind of building rapport with the individual. These are all my own ideas and theories now, but I think like even just from reading all the things and working on the literature review part of our paper, it's definitely, you can't be in there. I'm going to say the read technique. I think it's too aggressive, right? So I think rapport building, communication, like being honest, all gets you the best results.
All right. So is it the carrot or the stick?
I think it is the carrot with the stick in the rear view mirror.
Walk softly and carry a big stick, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, good. All right. Well, so let's get into you starting as an analyst then. What are your first tasks there at the district attorney when you just start? Because as you mentioned, they're wanting to start a unit up and this is just getting off the ground. So what do you walk in the door first couple of days? What are they having you do?
Yeah. So first couple of days, all of us are like, oh, crap. Now what do we do? And we're trying to figure out, it's myself, it's two attorneys, and then one other woman who is an analyst. She's already doing some work in an analytical capacity, doing more kind of forensic work, but she's working with us as well. And the idea actually came to the attorneys because they were in charging and they would see individuals come through the charging process and they would know, like they recognize them from either being repeat offenders or from knowing that they were like group affiliated, and they would be like, well, we have no like process or system to share this information that we know in the back of our head, but like we can't cover every case, of course. So we need to set up and be this kind of channel of information from the police to the DA's office so that all of that intel and the work that the police are doing goes beyond just its purpose for arrest, but it can also be used in prosecution. So that was kind of our overall arching goal. It was to serve as this channel, break down some silos that were both within our office and between the different law enforcement offices in Philadelphia.
All right. So is it mainly, at least in the very beginning, it sounds like this is mostly data coming from the police departments as they're dealing with it on a DA's office, as opposed to information that the DA is giving and working its way back to the police department.
That's definitely the main flow of information is coming from police. We would occasionally, very rarely, you know, get some extra information from either a victim or witness who showed up and said something, or maybe a family member of a defendant who was in court and they said something to the attorney. And then we would like take it back the opposite way and we would bring it to police and say, hey, we heard this. Is this true? Or do you know anything about this? But yeah, so most of our work was taking what the police were doing and kind of integrating it into the work with the attorneys. And so like we do all the normal DA intel things, like we host our arrest alert system, of course. And so we have multiple different categories, you know, some will hold the individual at charging, others don't, kind of similar to what other district attorney's offices have done or are doing. And that's been cool because then we're able to, you know, get right on the ball as soon as possible and kind of pinpoint and focus in on individuals when needed. And then a lot of our work also this whole time and still has been like building these relationships, because we now have seats down at our Fusion Center, which is the Delaware Valley Intelligence Center, which we didn't have before. We had to, you know, write up our whole MOU to get us in there, build trust, just sit down there and smile, you know, wave to the police officers, become friends with the civilian analysts, because the Philadelphia Police Department does have a large cohort of civilian analysts working with them as well. And so that's like an everyday. We were working on that, building that up. And even now we're still doing that, but just looking back on the past few years and like how much more collaborative everyone is compared to when we started is insane. And I feel lucky since we only do have one police department in our county, unlike the others who do have handfuls and way too many to count. We have our one police department, our one district attorney's office. So that does make communication a little bit easier. And we've really tried to stand ourselves up and say, you know, hey, we're here. We're trying to prove ourselves. We're showing you what we can do. We can help you. We can get your information to the attorneys and try to get all that information from arraignment and charging all the way to sentencing, so that information is not, you know, being wasted or going into the abyss.
Gotcha. So I envision when you're at a police department as an analyst, you know, depending on their requester, can I get a general idea what the requester is after? Obviously, if it's a detective, there's certain tactical or intelligence type information that he or she's going to be after. If it's an executive, mm-hmm. it may be more of a strategic, or if they're problem solving task, you kind of get an idea of what they're after. I'm curious, with the DA, what are they after when it comes to what they're asking of you?
Yeah. So we don't do so much, of course, like the tactical and the on the ground stuff, but what we are doing is kind of like that criminal intelligence. So it's like the groups and why these groups are fighting back and forth, and like the history between, you know, group A versus group B, and why now group C is involved. So we're trying to bring all of that to the attorneys who maybe would not have known, and who maybe would have just thought, you know, this person was just the run of the mill offender and here they are in court and then I'm going to pass their file on. But we want to really just let them know, like, hey, this person actually, even though maybe this is their first arrest and their first time coming through the system, there's actually all this other information on them. And actually they're, you know, family members with so-and-so who's in a war with whoever else. And so we are trying to like really beef up those people and separate them so that, you know, things are done more intelligently, smart prosecution, you know, it's focused and more resources are given to those individuals who deserve or need more resources given to them.
Yeah. Now, in the beginning, did you have access to the police department's records management system or CAD and the different databases at the police department?
Some and not all. And even mm-hmm. even now, still some, but not all. That also has been like from developing relationships and building trust. We, of course, do have our own, but then the police has like allowed us to come on to like their ArcGIS systems and all of their mapping and their various documentation, like RMSs. We're in the process of like changing out our RMS system, so it's been a little crazy right now, but we do have all of our own here in the DA's office, and then they have their own. So we got to learn a whole bunch of new systems as well. And then we are basically the intermediary for now, because as for now, they do not communicate on the back end. So it is just us asking for something and then passing it on. And hopefully that can change, you know, when we get some new tech around here.
Okay, so you're obviously, in talking with you and meeting you last year, you're obviously a people person. I'm guessing that's what's fueled this idea of breaking down these walls and working with the analysts and detectives and whatnot from the police department. I guess just kind of talk about that, of just how you went about building rapport with the police department.
Yeah, definitely love to go out there and be annoying and introduce myself. So that was one of the good things when they hired me. They're like, great, because when you go sit down there and you know you gotta make friends, we have confidence in you. And I was like, great, yeah, I'm gonna do it. So it was great, because some of the like civilian analysts that we sat nearby, I went to school with, and others like also went through the same program maybe prior, and then others still, I'm always looking for a connection between me and someone else. So I'm always trying to figure out what we're going to talk about and how I can, you know, how we can connect on something. So that it's basically that. I am friends with all of them down there now, officers, analysts in all the different units. I'm still meeting new people to this day. And even in the DA's office, I came in like right before COVID. So I didn't even get to meet a lot of people face to face before we were all sent home. And then after we were sent home, then I was sent to go sit at the Fusion Center. So I know so many people's names and I know their email addresses, right? But I don't speak to people in person a lot, but great rapport. You know, you got to kill them with kindness in the email. Everyone is very kind back. Everyone's supportive. Everyone is happy to share information and ask for help. And even if we don't have anything, they're, you know, still very appreciative that we were able to like look into someone and check it out. So it's the kill them with kindness.
Gets you
a lot of places.
It is fascinating to think about the idea of, you know, being a people person, but then having to do it through an email. Right. And I can just envision the you going through the process and just anticipating questions or what they want to hear, and just normal what your process would be if you were meeting them and you're trying to build rapport with them face to face. You're then saying like, okay, what do they want to hear in this email?
Mm-hmm. Right. Usually I am trying to delete exclamation points out of my email, because I will have like 7 to start off, and then I have to go back and edit, and I'm like, but the period sounds so mean, and I maybe add a comma, and then I can combine it into 1 exclamation point. So yeah, I am always, you know, happy Monday, happy Tuesday, happy Wednesday. And everyone's like, it's not happy Wednesday. And I'm like, well, it is actually. How are you today? And so I'm sure it's obnoxious to some, but like, if it's not out there all the time, I'm going to be the one to put it out there. So I will bring the positivity. And yeah, it's helped and gotten me, I think, a lot of things. Helps me like meet new people, especially with like setting up the regional association, which I'm sure we'll get into that, you know, all my exclamation points in those emails, working with all of the board members. It's just, I'm always way too excited.
Hey, this is Shauna Gibson from the Pacific Northwest. This is to all you crazy PEMCO drivers out there. Do you know what a zipper merge is? It is when you let somebody else get in front of you and then somebody comes in behind you. You really don't have to push everybody out. So may you all learn the zipper merge, and may the 405 and I-5 be a little bit more pleasant to drive down. Good luck with that, all of you crazy drivers.
Hi, my name is Brian Napolitano, and I'm here to talk about name badges. When you're attending a training or a conference, please make sure your name badge is at an appropriate height and is legible enough so that strangers won't be staring where they shouldn't, just so they can figure out your name. Thank you for listening.
So I really want to try to drive home for with the audience exactly what you all are doing there. So can you take me through maybe if you don't want to talk details of the case, that's fine, but at least just talk us through data that you analyzed and how it just worked from beginning to end.
So a day in the life.
There you go.
Yeah. So we have so many different things that we have our hands in. So we work with the city and the police in our focus deterrence effort. So we sit in on those meetings. We are making sure that those individuals that are involved get special attention for their court cases as well. We're trying to make sure that, you know, oh, this incident happened, this shooting happened, and it's because of this reason. We pass that along to the attorney to make sure they know, or if there is some sort of like kind of heavy-handed action happening, we will be involved in that. And we'll like go through all the cases for all of the group individuals and say, hey, these ones, there's, you know, a lot of information, a lot of background information on them. We can pass this to the attorney again so that they know that this is not just your run-of-the-mill person. That's one of our things. The arrest alert, we're always updating, adding, subtracting people. We'll get alerts any time of day, and we try to have someone answer them, you know, as soon as possible, so that if they're in the charging process, they're not getting held up, but so that even at the charging level, those attorneys are informed. We also look at individuals going through diversion programs. So we don't want to accidentally put someone, you know, who's maybe group affiliated in a diversion program, or someone who maybe is not necessarily group affiliated, but there is a lot of information on them. There's maybe something back and forth going on. And if there's any extra intel, we are going to pass it so that, you know, we don't accidentally put someone in a diversion program, they get out, and then everyone's like, and they recommit a crime. Everyone's like, wait, why are they there? Oh, because no one checked. We're trying to check that. So hopefully that doesn't happen. We're also working with so we just transitioned leadership. We're now absorbed into a new unit, the Gun Violence Task Force. And so we're helping, there's analysts there who are doing like forensic work. So we're helping them. We're helping like look into specific groups, supporting them in all of their grand jury investigations as well. And then anything gun violence related, we are also tracking the gun cases that come through the DA's office. So we will, one of our projects has been to pull those cases every week, have some senior attorneys track those and review them and say, hey, this one might have an issue later on. Just flag it just to be sure, just to, you know, give it some extra detail just in case. And then we've been tracking how those cases move through the system. So we've been looking at, you know, why things get dismissed or withdrawn or whatever happens to be the case for the outcome. And so that's something that's been interesting. And we've got about two and a half years worth of data on the gun case that we've been tracking. And so I think we're about to kind of try to implement something now, because actually the biggest category for why our cases are getting dropped is because the victim or witness doesn't show up to court. So that could be, of course, for so many reasons, but we're going to try to do something there, try to either get the why, or either maybe support them in the, if they're afraid, if it's like a domestic situation, we got to figure it out. And of course, since I was a victim advocate, I'm particularly excited to be working on that and trying to get them to come to court. And if not, you know, we need to know how we can better support you and how we can support future victims or witnesses when coming to court. So yeah.
So what trends are you seeing with the gun data?
Our numbers, like the majority, I think it's around 40%, are that the victim and witnesses are not showing up. And it's been pretty much the same, even like comparing it over time. That is like overwhelmingly the biggest category for why our cases, you know, will get dropped. And then I wanted to break that down even further. And so I was just interested in looking at, you know, which are domestic violence and which are maybe just like neighborhood acquaintances and something happens, or like which are random. And of course, you know, the ones that are random, and if you don't live near the person, you are probably more likely to come to court because you're not afraid that you're going to see them in the street, you know. But also those are way less frequent than the ones where it is a domestic situation, or it is a familial thing, or something where the offender and the victim live nearby. So those are the ones. And that, like, as a victim advocate and as someone who's worked with the court system for years, like, I know they're not coming, and I know why. And even with like relocation services that are available, you know, it's often not enough, and it's hard to get people to come to court if you can't, you know, kind of guarantee that 100% we can move you here, or 100% certain this person will, you know, not be coming out of jail, and they will not be bothering you for, you know, said time. So that's my question. If anyone has any tips on how to get them to come to court.
Yeah. All right. Looking back on setting up the unit then, what sticks out when you think back about setting up the unit and establishing it? Like, I mean, roadblocks, lessons learned. What do you think about?
Yeah. So like I was saying, we just went through a transition. We have a new supervisor of the unit And I'm really excited for that. She is someone who I was saying I wanted her to be the supervisor for the past few months when I knew that we were getting a new one. So I'm really excited. And I think she is like the perfect direction for us to go in, because I think our first like kind of director of the unit was great at building relationships. He was great at setting up, you know, contacts and getting us started and getting us involved and getting us in the door and where we needed to be to set up everything and to be where we are now. So that was like a perfect time and perfect leadership then. And I think now that we are kind of more established, we have our new supervisor and she wants to get into it. She wants to do things more actively, less kind of waiting around for the cases to come. She wants to have us all like helping out with active investigations and stuff. So it's very exciting to see it have come this far. And it's great because I didn't want us to, you know, be stuck in what we were doing. And so she is bringing new life into our unit and it's really great. As far as roadblocks, I'm trying to think. If you just add exclamation points, you know, they get you past most roadblocks. I would say that that is still a challenge, is those relationships. And they are for sure not, you know, 100% better and 100% resolved. Our relationship with the police and our other law enforcement partners, it ebbs and flows. And we have people that we work with closely who are like, yeah, we'll work with you anytime, anytime, anytime. And then there are others who, you know, maybe my unit doesn't work with as closely specifically. And so they're a little hesitant. So it's still winning over those people. And it's still trying to build those things, put in exclamation points, you know, bring in the donuts, because I do that also occasionally. So I think that is just something that will never end. But I think you can't give up, because we're here to share, right? The Fusion Center is for us to collaborate. We've built great contacts between other law enforcement agencies as well, even just by existing down there. So, and I think it really showed that the DA's office was also here to move into, you know, the next phase of like all this intelligence-led policing and, you know, making things kind of streamlined and precise with what everyone's doing. So exclamation points, they're the answer.
Yeah. I guess besides more exclamation points, what do you think's next for the unit?
So with our new supervisor, we're getting into the more active stuff. So we are, you know, working on doing social media training so that we can assist in that way. We're trying to make sure also that we're really focusing in and we don't just keep these, you know, lists and however we've been doing things the same. We're trying to innovate and kind of like, you know, update our processes so that we are improving always, right? And so I think what's next is, yeah, just these getting more active. So we're now a unit of one supervisor, not myself, that's the attorney, and then myself and two analysts. So to me, that's huge, because now there's like myself and two other analysts, there's three of us. And for the whole prior time, the prior 2 years, it's been me, myself. So I'm like, wow, the workload, we can triple the workload. We can do so much. So even after we have just hired the two new analysts, they have been so helpful, so great. I feel like we put out more work products than we ever have, which makes sense, tripling the work power. But they both are experienced. They both came from police departments as well, and they're ready to work. We have a great like working group with the four of us, and I'm excited.
Yeah. Now, do you allow those other analysts to use exclamation points?
No one uses them quite like I do, but they know, and they were at police departments, so they know the deal. And they know we gotta kill them with kindness, and I think they're gonna get there.
Yeah.
I'll text them later. Reminder. Exclamation point.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you obviously like to use exclamation points. What about emojis? I've seen that debate a little bit of whether emojis belong in work
in an email.
Yeah.
Jason, this is a hard question.
I know.
I will use them, you know, if it's like an informal email, if it's just like something quick. For sure. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I will use them in like a catch-up email also, even if it's a little more formal. It's not going to be a crazy emoji. It's just going to be like a smiley face. Just a happy, you know, takes my exclamation points up 7 notches. But luckily also there's, you know, like Microsoft Teams, so I can, you know, use them to my heart's content in there. But I do try to limit my emoji use in emails. So if you get one, I really need something from you. I'm trying to be really nice.
Yeah, I do find myself just naturally doing it as if, because I think I text that way.
Right.
My emails have come that way. And I do find, while I think probably my ilk, the boomer generation, old man elder here, would frown upon it, I do believe that emojis do help that you're not being a jerk. Right. I think so, that sometimes your words get misconstrued. And I feel that emojis help the reader realize that, hey, I'm not purposely being a jerk here. I mean, definitely. If I leave the poop emoji, obviously I am. But I mean, like, normally I don't leave that. Right.
Right. For sure. And I definitely am not recommending that everyone, you know, send emojis to everyone all the time. But I do agree that they do help convey emotion, and they can make things more lighthearted or more, you know, sincere or whatever, more exciting, depending on the circumstances. I agree with you.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the IACA then. Before I do, I forgot to mention earlier, we'll take your calls today. We are doing favorite first jobs. So if you have a favorite first job, please call us. Ooh. And so, as I mentioned in the beginning, we met in Chicago for last year's IACA conference. And then we saw each other again here in just recently in Grapevine, Texas. And so I did a review of the Grapevine conference. I'll put a link in the show notes for this episode. But I just wanted to get your take on the last two conferences, what you thought, because I do feel that they contrast really well. Chicago was downtown, and Grapevine was not downtown, kind of outskirts in this like spread out huge hotel, versus we were kind of compact right. in Chicago, but we were also downtown Chicago, so there was also a lot going on. So I just want to give you opportunity to kind of, as a fairly, just these are your first two IACA conferences, so I wanted to give you the floor a little bit and talk about what you thought.
Yeah, they were great. And I know we had talked about them yesterday, and then I went to go listen to your review. And I know you pointed out like being downtown versus being kind of removed from the city. And I agree with you that I had way more fun at this one. And then when you said maybe it was because of the location, because when as soon as you exited Chicago, you know, you're out with whoever else is in Chicago, versus here we were in this resort. And, you know, then you really got to get to know these people, you know, and you're making friends with other analysts and other people who are there at the conference, because there's almost 800 of us there, and we're all in this area going to the same four restaurants. I think after you had said all that, I agree, because even last year when I was in Chicago, I went off and I saw like family who lived in Chicago, and I saw a friend who I also have who lives in Chicago. And then this year I was in this hotel all the way until Thursday, when I was like, I need to get out. But I'm having so much fun. Like every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, even Sunday night, it was with all the people that I was meeting and the people that I knew. I also came with a bigger group from our office this year than last year, so maybe that contributed to it. But I also had like a bigger network of people that I knew outside of our office this year. But I did really love this one. I know you were not so excited for Vegas next year, but I don't know how I feel, because after you said that about going out into Gen Pop in Chicago, I was like, oh no, you're right. As soon as we walk out the doors, I'm going to lose all my analyst friends, and it's everyone in the real world. So we'll see. But I really, really loved this last conference. And I feel like I learned different things than I learned last year. And there were different presentations than there were last year. And even like being in it, you know, fairly newer last year compared to this year, like I felt that there was still a good amount of information to learn. And like, that was new. I was afraid, you know, that maybe I would come here and I had already heard these things, or I've heard these presentations, or I know this and blah, blah, blah. But it was great. Had a great time. Met even more people, and got to meet some of the other Maraca board members for the first time also.
Yeah. So did you have a favorite session?
Actually, yes. Let me, because I can't remember the title of it. It was on the last day, actually. And I think you also mentioned in yours how much you appreciated like the international aspect, and how you had the presenters from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And you really like that. My session. I'm trying to pull up my app because I still got my app downloaded. It was Security Data Governance Systems, and it was from Carola Jaronsky, and she is from, I believe, Buenos Aires. Yeah, Argentina. So she was presenting, and I went in there thinking it was going to be like a really technical presentation on like data governance systems and how they relate and all the security that you need on it. But it was actually about, you know, all of their policing and their strategies in Argentina. And it was really, really cool. And it was so different. So I felt like I learned the most and was like the most refreshed by that session. So that was my favorite, actually. I think it was the last session that I went to before I had to get on a flight.
No, very cool. Very cool. I guess anything that you want to see next year in Vegas?
I don't know. More pig races? I don't know. pig race. No,
Exclamation point.
Yeah, exactly. No, I had a great time in Texas. Yeah, Brittany did great putting on everything. I feel like this year I also used the app more. I don't know if there were changes to it from last year to this year. I wasn't paying attention to it so much last year, but it was very helpful to have that and to be able to like connect with people. I used it, of course, to network with people who didn't know who I was. So I would search by people's office in their city and I would just go adding people. And then I would have people come up and be like, are you the person who added me on the app? And I'd be like, yes, exclamation point. My name is Akko, and you also work at a prosecuting office, and so do I. Let's talk.
Yeah.
So I liked the app a lot this year also.
Yeah. You should put in for a presentation next year.
About exclamation points and emojis?
Thanks.
Okay. Cheesesteak emoji. This is all we have in Philadelphia. Me, my cheesesteaks, and these exclamation points.
Yes. Yes. How many exclamation points is too many?
Oh, yeah. No, it would be like an Easter egg. Find the exclamation point on every slide. Plot twist, there's like 30 on every slide.
Yeah. No, but I would think that the perspective of a DA intelligence analyst would be something that would be enlightening to folks. So
I agree. And yeah, so some of my other coworkers said the same thing. They were like, maybe next year we should go talk about, you know, how we operate, what we do. Mm-hmm. Because in the past, like there were... I know in Chicago, like Sean Rambaran talked about the arrest alert system that they have and how that worked and the good, the bad, and the ugly and everything that, you know, could happen. So that was cool. And I agree. Maybe we need to go out there and, you know, say, hey, this is what we do. And it could be, you know, us and maybe another office, because the other offices that do have the multiple jurisdictions and police departments do, you know, kind of different work. So it could be like a little 30 minute, what your intel unit in your prosecuting office can do for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to write that down now.
See, it writes itself. So, all right. Well, let's talk about Morocco now. So I'm really hoping that there is a fascinating, interesting story about the creation of the RAC Morocco.
Oh, boy.
So much pressure.
Yes. So I think there was one of the presentations by the RAC that was like, how to start your own regional association. And they were like, at the end, if you say yes, we will, you know, connect you to the people in your region. So I guess myself and some other people were there and everyone said yes. They put us on an email chain together and we just started talking. I think like around January of this year, was when we first started getting things together. And there was maybe like 10 or 5, somewhere between there, on each of our little meetings that we would have. And we were just like, okay, like what areas do we include? And what is our purpose? And how the heck do we do this? And we need a name and all of that. So I forget how many people like voted, but however many people we had in the beginning, we submitted a bunch of acronyms, you know, and just let everyone vote. And Morocco came to be the favorite. And I actually put Morocco in there as a joke because I thought no one would choose it because it already is a thing. And lo and behold, it was by a landslide it won. So that was the name. We went from there. We like wrote up our bylaws. We had our board. No one wanted to do it. So the 5 of us that are here, you know, basically all of us were just like, I'll do something. I'll help. And so that's how we got it. But everyone has been so great and so helpful. And really in the last few months, like we've really come into everything that we have. We like got our nonprofit filing done, bank account, a PO box. I'm like, what? We have a bank account? And we're getting our website set up. We have a woman who volunteered to be like our social media person. So we've got all that, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. And then actually our Liberty Mid-Atlantic HIDA is sponsoring us and funding our website for the first year. So we have some partners already. And of course, you know, we had all of our fun swag to give away at the conference, but it's really coming along. We have like 140 on our email list. And then we just started doing our membership and our like our dual membership with the IACA. So we've got people starting to pay, and then we've got some trainings that we've got coming up that we will start putting out to our members as well. And we made lots of great connections at the conference, met people at all the other associations, met new people for our association. We had a little meet and greet happy hour one day. It was awesome. And it's crazy because what, 9 months ago, we literally had nothing. And now we're trying to put out trainings and coordinating events with other groups. So it's been cool. And I love it. And, you know, exclamation points really got us here.
Nice. So what's the jurisdiction for Maraca?
Yes. So we are Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. And then we did just meet some people in the DC area who were like, hey, what about us? So we're going to take them in also, just tweak our bylaws a little bit. But we don't have like a specific restriction. So if someone is not in one of those states but still wants to join, they definitely still can if you're in the area or for whatever reason. But that's our primary area. We've been having quarterly meetings, and we hopefully can have something in person in December. That's what we're planning for. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Man. So are you stopping on anybody's toes? Like, there's VCAN. You're not taking any of their territory, are you?
No, not yet. I'm just kidding. They've been really helpful also. And so has the Massachusetts Association. We've been working with both of their leadership. Actually, every association has helped out because we needed help with like writing the bylaws and getting the nonprofit filing status and like just stuff with the treasurers working out like how all of that's supposed to go down. And everyone has offered to help and reached out to us. So it's been very great. And we've gotten a lot of support.
All right. Well, very good. So it sounds like you got a pretty good start. When did you actually start? Like, when did you start this process? And like, when were you officially established?
Probably started like end of last year, I think, was maybe when the like RACS presentation was. Mm-hmm. And then we like got our like baby board of people together in January. And so like we have like executive board meeting minutes from like January. Or February, I believe. And then we've been having just like the unofficial kind of general body meetings every quarter just to like update people on what's going on and reach out to see if anyone else wants to, you know, volunteer for anything. And then it was just in like the last couple months that we got our filing status and everything else set up, like our EIN and all that stuff that no one wants to do.
Yeah. It sounds like you're doing all the boring work, but it sounds like it's all paying off. I didn't think about it, but geez, you can have one of these racks set up in 6 months.
Yeah, it's been crazy. And actually, we were just saying that the three of us who were at the IACA, we were like, wait, everything just happened all at once. We were like working and trying and trying to get everything together from like January till maybe like July. And then all of a sudden we got like our PO box, we got the EIN, we got a bank account, we got the nonprofit stuff, we got like the website is coming. It will be up like hopefully by the end of the year and with HIDA's support. So it all happened really quick. So now we're like, oh crap, now we got to do more.
Yeah. But and is that HIDA? Which HIDA is that?
That's the Liberty Mid-Atlantic HIDA.
Okay.
In Pennsylvania. Yeah.
I gotcha. All right. Very good.
They've been great. Yeah, it's been fun.
All right, let's move on to favorite first jobs then, Akiko. So we got some callers on the line, and they are going to talk about their favorite first job. For the listeners, in case you're first time listening to this segment, I got this idea from Steve Gottlieb when he was on the show, because in high school, his first job was working at a radio station. And he worked his way up to actually being the DJ on the Sunday morning show at his local radio station. And he was like 16, 17 years old. So I always like to ask people what they did as their first job. So first on the line is Lori. Lori, what's one of your favorite first jobs?
One of my favorite first jobs was working for a private investigation firm, and we would have to get information out of people and use a lot of social engineering to get them to disclose their current address so that we could then serve them with a, you know, court order. So that was a lot of fun because we had to come up with new and inventive ways to get the people to give us information they really shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's like tricking them. Did that happen in Philadelphia? Didn't the one time I should probably Google it, but they had all these wanted people. So they told them that I think they either won the lottery or won Super Bowl tickets and said, advertise that. And they ended up arresting all these people because they all came in to get either their lottery ticket or their Super Bowl tickets. Does that sound familiar at all?
You know, I'm going to plead the fifth there, but it does sound like something we would do.
Yeah.
It would definitely attract a lot of people. Yeah, easily.
Yeah, so that's some trickery. I mean, that's definitely trying to convince people to give up information that they're not wanting to give up. That's a really cool first job, actually.
Yeah, definitely. You should have her back and elaborate on that. We want to know the techniques.
Next on the line is TJ. TJ, what's one of your favorite first jobs?
One of my favorite first jobs was being a resident advisor. I met so many great lifelong friends and got so many interesting stories from that. So definitely would highly recommend being a resident advisor.
I was an RA. How about that?
Really? I feel like I should have been one.
Yes, I was an RA for 2 years in undergrad, sophomore and junior year. Ooh. And it wasn't too bad. I mean, it was more annoying than anything else, especially when, you know, you're trying to do other things and there's an issue with one of your residents and that's just right. Being obnoxious. But for the most part, I enjoyed being a RA I do feel that you get to know folks, folks within the dorm because of that, as opposed to, you know, I guess if you're a social body, you know, like you. You probably know everybody in the dorm anyway, but I didn't. So it was a way for me to get to know more people at the dorm.
Did you make any lifelong friends from being an RA specifically? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks to Facebook, right? I still keep up with some of them. So it is interesting. In college, you think of it was like there's different people with different studying and all that. Like you would just probably never talk to them, but if they happened to be your neighbor in the dorm, then you became buddies. Right.
Right. Exactly. That's perfect. That's a good way to do that.
So, all right. Next on the line is Dana. Dana, what's one of your favorite first jobs?
Favorite first job would be I worked at a tennis club in the Bay Area in Los Gatos. And it was like, I don't know why it was so cool, but you got access to the gym, you got access to their spa, you could go use the pool whenever you wanted. So as a, you know, 19, 20 year old college student, that was pretty awesome to have access to all that stuff. So best first job right there.
Yeah.
That is nice. I do that, you know, when I teach dance, I use it, you know, so that I can go take other classes for free. So I understand that. You got to get the extra perks.
Yeah, I think it is. I used to work at a gym too. And it is interesting. It's funny. I worked at a gym, but did not work out. So at the time, and so it was interesting just to watch people at the gym because there was clearly people there that were just there to socialize.
Did they ever ask you for tips and tricks? And you're like,
yeah, like, well, they look at me and say, I'm not asking that guy, you know, that's that's what not to do. Right.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Goes on to for the don't be that analyst, you know, don't be that guy.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Next on the line is Rachel. Rachel, what's one of your favorite first jobs?
So my favorite first job was working as an operational research analyst for the National Air Traffic Services. But basically, I was modeling the runway capacities at London Gatwick and Heathrow airports to see whether we could safely add any more departures and arrivals, you know, optimizing the mix of aircraft types. And I became such an airplane nerd. I was like working in the control towers and listening to RT. And if I'm perfectly honest, I probably still am. I just don't vocalize it all that often.
That's actually a really cool job. Like I can imagine there being so many great stories working at an airport.
Oh my gosh, do I need to do that now? Wait a second. Yeah. That sounds really cool.
It does. And then it's data driven too. So they're trying to figure out how to change the way they do business. So man, that is a really awesome job, the first job that Rachel had.
Yeah, that is cool.
All right, next on the line is Mary. Mary, what's one of your favorite first jobs?
My favorite first job, I was working at a pool company in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Right. And did anything fun and exciting happen there? What's memorable?
I actually like testing, doing all the water samples. That sounds really stupid, but it was like, I wouldn't go in your pool.
That's great. I don't even want to know.
Yeah, no, that is funny, testing all the samples, because I hate to do that. I have a pool now and I hate to go do all that testing and all that other stuff, let alone to do it for somebody else. But I guess if you're getting paid, it's not as bad.
Yeah. And if you got a pool, then you can, look and creep on everyone else's pool for inspiration and, how maybe you want to model yours.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it probably would be interesting to be nosy, because everybody, if you have a pool, most likely you have a privacy fence. And so it would be, if you want to be nosy to your neighbors, like that would be a way to get in the backyard.
Still sounds hot though. Hot and sweaty out there.
All right. So that is favorite first jobs. If you have a favorite first job, let us know what it is at leapodcast@gmail.com. All right, Akiko, let's finish up with personal interests. And for you, it seems like you have like 27 part-time jobs. So you're a dance instructor, you work at the bar, I don't know how you have time to do anything, but how long have you been dancing?
All right. So the dancing has been something since I was little, of course, and did it all through high school into college. I didn't do it as much. I did like a kind of recreational dance team in college. But then after that, I came out, I danced with like a local company for a little bit, and then also teaching kids at that time. So, and that was great. I taught at the studio for 5 years, was a great time. And then recently I just switched over to teaching adults, and I think I might like that more.
It's because the kids don't get the exclamation point, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't get the curse word with the exclamation point behind it. Correct. But
yeah, so you feel you can be a little bit more stern with the adults?
Exactly. And it's not even necessarily stern, because all the adults, they're paying. It's coming out of their own pocket. So they all want to be there. I watch them drop out of my class, every now and then on the roster. But all of them are like eager to be there. It's really fun. It's only 2 days a week. It's like right after work and my Saturday morning. So it's easy. It's nearby my house. And I feel like it's not even work. I'm having such a great time dancing around.
Nice. Nice. And then is bartending just for fun, or why are you bartending?
Bartending is also right near my house. That's even closer. It's like 2 blocks away. But so I moved into this area like a year and a half ago. And I found this bar and I was like, I actually miss, again, you said I was a people person. I miss the people aspect of either talking to victims or, working in a restaurant. I worked in a restaurant in high school and all through college. So I was like, do you guys need anybody? I used to work in a restaurant, but it's been a few years. I can do like a couple shifts and like nothing during the day because I got a regular job. So they like called me back. We like chatted, and I only do 2 days there also. But I do like Sunday day and Monday night. And so they're probably some of the slower shifts, but I like that. And I get to meet a lot of new people. My favorite thing to do is roll silverware. So if anyone wants to race me anytime, I bet I can beat them. But I'm just there bartending, and it's great. Now that like football is back, it's going to be busier. I'm ready for football to be over. Just kidding. But just, I like this. I like the slowness, and I like going in, like, getting to know the regulars and talking about the neighborhood. And it's also, I live in an area down near the airport. So we do get a lot of people like traveling, waiting for their flight or about to head out or going to pick someone up. So there's a lot of people to meet and a lot of stories to hear. And it's great. Then I also don't go out and spend money. I sit there and make money and hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like you do get access to a variety of people. Do you have a favorite drink that you like to make?
To make? Not so much. To drink, my drink of choice is a dirty gin martini. So I'll make it. But, not many people are trying to drink my favorite drink. So,
yeah, I like old fashions, but, no one's surprised by old man elder liking old fashions. But it's kind of cliche.
Those are good, too. No, those are nice. We don't do anything crazy or fancy at my bar, but I can make you one of those if you ever come stop by Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, yeah, I need to make it to Philadelphia because I am a PA boy, but I was telling you that I have, of all the areas that I've been in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia has really escaped me. I've only been to the Philadelphia airport. I've never spent any time in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I was shocked when you told me that. And then I was ranting to someone else. I was like, how can he be from here? And he's never even been to Philadelphia. So that really, you got to come visit, Jason.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, there's a little bit of rivalry there. I mean, we can't even agree on convenience stores.
Correct. It is,
you know, Wawa versus Sheetz.
Yeah, it's Wawa all the way. Don't get it confused.
Yeah, I'm actually a Sheetz guy. Big surprise. But well, anyway, see?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
All right, very good, Akiko. Our last segment of the show is Words to the World. This is where I give the guest the last word. You can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
All right, so my words to the world is this phrase, everything is everything. And if you don't pay attention to it, right, it means like nothing and it sounds like gibberish. But to me, I feel like everything is connected, not in some sort of butterfly effect type of way. But I'm just saying, like, when you go out and you meet people and you network, like that can help you somewhere later on. Or if you're doing some sort of analysis, even if that specifically doesn't relate to something else later, you will remember an experience or something that you did that will help you later on. So it can kind of conveys the idea that everything is interconnected and everything plays a role in the order and how things, you know, proceed moving forward. So everything is everything. And with that also, you know, not everything has to be so important because everything will, you know, work itself out.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you give me just enough to talk bad about you later.
I should have asked to say that part too.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Akiko. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason. Could you send your autograph?
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.